Good morning and welcome to JFK Spotlight on Health. It's brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health, JFK University Medical Center. Keep getting better. I'm Joel Katz, and joining me this week is Dr. Joshua Zimmerman, board-certified orthopedic surgeon specializing in shoulder and elbow surgery at JFK University Medical Center, Hackensack Meridian Health. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning. How are you, Joel?
Good, good. Thank you for joining us for the program. Going to learn a lot today, a lot of topics that we want to go over, a lot of things that I had never heard of. So let's start with something that most people may not be familiar with. I'm not sure how common it is, and that is adhesive capsulitis. And it has to do with the shoulder, right?
It does have to do with the shoulder. And despite the fact that everybody knows what a rotator cuff tear is, like that, adhesive capsulitis probably as common a shoulder injury as that. And when I use the word injury, that's probably not even correct. It would be more correct to say it is a condition of the shoulder.
Okay.
It is a very common thing to see. In the course of an average day in my office, I'll probably see at least four people that do have that diagnosis.
Wow. A day.
A day, a day. So, I mean, of course, I just do shoulders and elbows, so I have a skewed view of it, but it is it's a very, very common problem. So most people will come in, their first thought often is, you know, do I have a rotator cuff problem? Do I have something else? And it is something that you diagnose almost entirely on exam. And
okay.
When I say that, generally speaking, x-rays don't make the diagnosis. Even a high-quality MRI doesn't make the diagnosis. So it is a diagnosis that we make on the basis of a physical examination.
What are the symptoms?
The symptoms start with pain. Most people have pain. Most people do have some difficulty sleeping through the night with it. But the big diagnosis that separates it from these others is loss of range of motion. And when I say loss of range of motion, some people have loss of range of motion because their shoulder is painful or they have muscular weakness. And in cases like that, when we examine them, they will have good passive range of motion. And when we say passive range of motion, that means the patient themselves may not be able to lift the arm themselves, but somebody else may be able to lift the arm for them, meaning there's a muscular weakness or a pain thing.
Okay.
If somebody's got a frozen shoulder, their shoulder will not move no matter what. It is actually stuck.
That's a stupid question maybe, but can you force it up? That would cause damage.
And not force it up. That's so when it is a frozen shoulder, you cannot force it up. It really will only go so far, and that's as far as it goes, and it will not go any further.
Okay.
So the typical patient that has this, interestingly, it's really clustered in a small age group, and the age group is about 40 years old to 60 years old. You're much less likely to get this diagnosis over the age of 60, and you're much less likely to have this diagnosis if you're under the age of 40.
Okay.
And like any condition, people are always saying, you know, what did I do? How did this happen to me? Did I do something? Did I not move it? But the answer is it just happens, which is somewhat frustrating sometimes to come in and find out nothing you did, nothing you didn't do, no lifestyle changes. It just happens, but it's one of those things that just happens. And again, fairly common diagnosis.
So you don't, there's nothing that you can say actually causes it.
There's nothing that you can say that causes it. People have looked for causes, you know, for years and years for this. Some people think, is it viral? Is it an autoimmune thing? Is it from an injury? But really, the further you start looking into these, the answer is always no. There's really no good reason for it. And sometimes to look for clues, say, well, why is this happening in the age group? Why is it happening to certain groups of people? The one thing you can say, it is more common with blood sugar issues with diabetics. So somebody diabetic is more likely to have it, but many, many people that don't have any blood sugar issues have this. There are some lipid issues that some people can relate and say this happens. And people have even said, well, you know, menopause could cause it. But it really just happens that by happenstance, the age coincides with the age at which people get frozen shoulders. So really, even people thinking that is a menopausal thing isn't correct. And the answer they know that is men have this condition as well. And a menopause certainly wouldn't be part of their diagnostic criteria.
Okay, so what is, well, first of all, can you make a full recovery from this?
You can make a full recovery. So, interestingly, if somebody comes in with a frozen shoulder on day one, A lot of the discussion I'll have with them is the fact that we can do nothing at all. In many cases, we cannot treat your shoulder, and eventually you'll get better. But eventually is a long time away. It's between a year and a half to 2 years. So even without treatment, this condition can come on, make your shoulder very stiff and painful, and make you miserable for a while. And gradually, sometimes after 6 or 7 months, it starts to ease up and get a little better and a little better and a little better. In a minor condition, you know, I think it's okay to say, hey, you'll be better, but it may be a year and a half. But sometimes it is really painful and very debilitating. And in those cases, it's not appropriate to say, hey, don't worry about it, you'll be fine in a couple of years. So in those cases, we're looking into what the treatment options are.
So what's the treatment?
Treatment options. So number one is time. It absolutely is a time-related thing. The other thing that seems to help is an intra-articular cord shot, meaning a shot into the actual joint of the shoulder. Now, many people have had into the bursa of the shoulder, around the rotator cuff, things like that, but it is a separate area of the shoulder where frozen shoulder occurs. So the shot has to be in the shoulder joint. Now, even with that treatment, the main advantage is pain usually is significantly better when we do the shot. Most people have not such a long window till their best. So instead of being, you know, a couple of years, maybe we can cut that back to 9 months. Interestingly, physical therapy is very, very commonly recommended for a frozen shoulder because logically you're thinking, shoulder is stiff, it doesn't move so well. And the question is, can physical therapy change the natural history of this? And it's still debated whether therapy shortens the course of it or not. So even though it seems like, yeah, your shoulder's stiff, we're going to stretch it out, seems a logical leap. But in many cases, really time turns out to be the main form of treatment for it. If it's not going your way, and if things are getting worse and worse after 6 or 7 months, there is a very minor 10-minute surgical procedure that can rid you of the condition that has about a 90% success rate. So it's a very minor procedure, in and out the same day. And what we actually do is where the shoulder capsule is tightened, we release it with an arthroscopic manner, and it can be life-changing within a couple of weeks. So I just wanted to say that. I didn't want anybody to lose hope if they're out there with this diagnosis. It can be treated, and you don't have to suffer for years and years if it doesn't go your way.
Talking with Dr. Joshua Zimmerman, board-certified orthopedic surgeon specializing in shoulder and elbow surgery. Let's talk about, do a little pivot here, and talk about young athletes, specifically when they throw. Now, all my kids have either played Little League baseball or softball. I remember discussing with coaches and parents about how the amount of throwing a child does and what kind of pitching they do, because there's a limit to their pitch count, amount of days per week and so forth. But what about like a 12-year-old, for example, throwing curveballs on a regular basis? And I know a few adults who did that in their youth, they say it messed up their arm. But let's start with the amount of throwing, baseball or otherwise. What can you recommend?
Okay. So let me get to the pitch count.
Okay.
So it's a very common thing, you know, we see in our office, you know, pitchers anywhere between, you know, 8 and 25 years old. But a lot of these people that we see are somewhere in this 9 to 14-year-old age group. And pitch counts have become, you know, pretty well established in Little League. And, you know, the coaches are very familiar with it. But really, there's more to it than just that pitch count. Mm-hmm. So let's say somebody's, you know, between 9 and 12, they're at Little League age range. The general rule of thumb is that you have a pitch count of somewhere around 75 pitches. And most coaches are aware of it. Most parents are aware of it. And they're, they will stick to it. But there's more to the pitch count than just how many pitches can you do in a day. The rest of it is how many months a year are you playing? You know, it used to be when mm-hmm. I was growing up, people would play football, they'd play hockey, they'd play this, they'd play that, they would play baseball when it was baseball season. Now baseball season can be a year-round
thing,
particularly for some kids. So the recommendation, particularly when you're younger, is to really take a full 4 months of the year off of throwing. And that's not welcome news sometimes to, you know, the player, the parents, or the coaches.
If you're a pitcher,
If you're a pitcher,
yeah.
That is correct. I'm sorry if I didn't say that.
Well, I just wanted to be clear about it. I mean, catchers are throwing the ball just as many times as the pitcher, but they're not doing it with the velocity, and they're not twisting their arms like they do with curveballs and so forth.
Right. So there are no pitch counts or throw counts for the catcher because occasionally they do have a nice hard throw, but most of the time they're tossing the ball back to the pitcher, and that pitcher that we all see in the newspaper with the arm behind the head, that really unusual position, the catcher doesn't get into that. That's really for the pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
But when you mention catching, a lot of the good pitchers are really good athletes and people want them on the field, and they can get substituted in for catching. And that's when you don't recommend doing it. You don't want that pitcher who's limited by his pitch count to all of a sudden be the catcher where he's continuing to throw the following day after.
Now, what about the curves? I mean, you got a 12-year-old, doing the twist on the arm. Is that an issue?
Yeah, it is. So let me separate out the shoulder problems from the elbow problems.
Okay, great.
Generally speaking, when we make those recommendations as far as, the curveballs and the sliders and the junk pitches, we're not really as concerned about the shoulder because in some ways those other pitches are a lower velocity pitch and are easier on the shoulder. But those pitches are a problem for a little league elbow. Until boys are probably, 16, 17 years old and the girls are maybe 13, 14 years old, the growth plates in their elbow are still open. They haven't matured and closed yet. And with those types of pitches, curveballs, things like that, they put a strain on the growth plate in the elbow. So until boys reach about, 15, 16 and girls 13, 14, we like them to limit, the changeups and the fastballs and really just stick with pitch counts and fastballs.
And what are the procedures that you've had to perform on these kids who maybe have overdone it?
Well, I can tell you that the number one thing we try to do with kids is to not get to the point where we have to do a procedure on them.
Okay.
So we really try to avoid that. Everybody's familiar with the Tommy John surgery, things like that.
Yeah, I was just going to bring that up. Yeah.
So the Tommy John surgery is usually a little later. Usually you don't start to see somebody that may be in that needing that type of surgery until they're, even 17, 18. It is not a procedure you would do on somebody with open growth plates. And really our discussion with the parents and the coaches and the athlete when they are in that, that 9 to 15-year-old age range is, what is your goal? Do you want to be the best pitcher when you're 12, or are you looking to be the best pitcher when you're 17 or 18 years old? And most of these kids are looking for a future in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of our discussions are, hey, if you want to be the pitcher that you're going to be when you're 17, 18, headed to college, now is the time to shut it down. Now is not the time to double down on throwing harder and getting better. And, so it's a little unusual as a sport to have your strategy to not be to give it your all, really at the younger ages, really be conscious of the fact that there are open growth plates and you can do permanent damage. So getting back to the operation, the Tommy John procedure is the one you hear about most commonly. It occurs when these athletes either all at once or gradually tear the ligaments on the inside part of their elbow. And once that happens, they're really unable to continue pitching. There are some players that it's appropriate to consider whether you're going to proceed with an elbow surgery. Now, most people are not headed for a pro or even a high-level college career.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to be realistic with the athletes about what their throwing velocity is. I mean, if somebody's a great pitcher, but they're throwing 60, 70 miles an hour with a lot of accuracy, they're probably not looking to go to the next level. Now, when we hear kids that are, 80, 85, 90 miles an hour, that's the type of velocity that typically can get you to the next level.
Okay.
And we will discuss whether a elbow reconstruction procedure is indicated.
Now, if they're not a pitcher, would this surgery, is the Tommy John surgery ever done on someone who is not a pitcher, who doesn't want to pitch? Can you still operate your elbow easily and live a normal non-athletic life?
Yeah, I would, you would never say never, but it is 99.9% a pitching problem. You know, people can even throw from shortstop to first base, from the outfield to the infield, without that same stress that the pitching causes on the elbow. So the reason we're very cautious about, and first of all, they're kids, and mm-hmm. second of all, we're very cautious about doing that procedure because it has nothing to do with any other aspect of your life. It is entirely about pitching. And, you know, many kids play other sports, do other things, and they're not looking for a future in it. So they can continue to play. They can continue to hit, play the infield, outfield. It just is really a pitching issue, which at the end of the day is a small group of kids who we would consider surgery for.
Okay. Now, for those listening who have a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old, and you mentioned earlier about shutting it down is the best thing to do about that age. How much of a shutdown are we talking? No pitching? Once a year?
There are websites like PitchSmart, and a lot of the coaches are really very knowledgeable now about these types of things. And the information on there is very good. The recommendation really would be to shut it down for 4 months of the year. It doesn't have to be four continuous months.
Okay.
But probably 2 to 3 continuous months at a time, and maybe the fourth month at another time. But this is a discussion I've had with a lot of these young, really good pitchers. And it's not entirely true, but the discussion is there has never been a Little League World Series pitcher that has ever pitched in the major leagues. I think there's one exception. But when you put it to them that way, to say, hey, is your end game to be the Little League pitching World Series pitcher, then you continue to pitch. But if your goal is to be, you know, a really good pitcher later in life, there is no track record to say, hey, these really good 12-year-old pitchers ultimately become the great college and pro pitchers. There's no evidence of that. So, but my point is not don't pitch, but my point is, what's your goal? What do you want to do? And I really want to stress that shutting it down, whether it means that they're not a pitcher until they're start again at 13 or 14, or whether it means that they take seriously, you know, a full 4 months off. I want to stress the point that pitching and keeping at it is not in their best interest many times.
Great. I'm glad you clarified that, because shut it down could mean a number of things. So I'm glad we went over that.
I encourage them to keep playing baseball, keep hitting, keep playing the outfield, keep playing the infield. But it really means just don't pitch. And really for extent periods of time are important. And again, 4 months is a general rule of thumb for the year.
Okay. Dr. Joshua Zimmerman, board-certified orthopedic surgeon specializing in shoulder and elbow surgery at JFK University Medical Center. You mentioned earlier one of the most common, or could be the most common, the rotator cuff tears.
Yep.
A retracted rotator cuff tear. How does that happen? What is it?
Okay. So, rotator cuffs are not a one-size-fits-all diagnosis. Let's say a patient comes in, we suspect a rotator cuff tear, we get an MRI. And the MRI, it is not a test that is either yes, you have a tear, or no, you don't have a tear. It is a test that says yes, you have a tear, and how big is the tear? So what we are looking for in cases that we are considering for surgery, we're looking to see how big the tear is and what is the possible chance of success if we try to repair that tendon. An average size rotator cuff tear is not really very big. You could take a dime and cover the defect of what is an average size rotator cuff tear. So fairly, when you think of it that way, a fairly small defect, the success rate of fixing that dime size hole is excellent, more than a 90% success rate. And most people do well, but sometimes people come in and they have tears that are the size of half of a dollar, but they're much, much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And the end of the tendon is about 3 centimeters away from where it should be. And those are what we call retracted tears. And that makes us take a step back and say, is this repairable? And if it's not repairable, what options do you have? So when I'm saying repairable, I'm meaning repair your own tendon. And sometimes that's not possible. So just like any other people are familiar with ACL grafts, and things like that, where you use a tendon or something from another body part.
Right.
A similar thing can be done in the shoulder.
But then there is a shoulder replacement as well.
There's a shoulder replacement. So let's say somebody is 40 years old. They've got a retracted giant rotator cuff tear. You know, we are thinking along the lines of let's try to fix this by any means, because average shoulder replacement lasts about 18 years. That's not going to get you to the finish line when you're 40.
Right.
Now, if somebody comes in with a very large retracted tear and they are, let's say, 70, 75 years old, they are excellent candidates for a shoulder replacement. Now, there are two types of shoulder. Okay. The type that we're mostly familiar with is what is called an anatomic shoulder replacement. And when we say anatomic, we replace the shoulder where you put the ball of the shoulder, where the ball of the shoulder used to be.
Mm-hmm.
You put the socket of the shoulder where the socket used to be. That will not work if you have a rotator cuff tear, because it will just give you a metal shoulder and you'll still have the rotator cuff tear.
Okay.
So we need to pivot and do something called a reverse shoulder replacement, which interestingly enough puts the socket where the ball used to be, puts the ball where the socket used to be, but it changes the rotation of the shoulder in a way that allows you to function pain-free and well without a rotator cuff anymore.
Wow, that's interesting. So how do you come up with that? Because I would think that it wouldn't work because it's going to go in an opposite direction, but you're reversing everything.
That's an excellent question. And if you look back at the history of orthopedic surgery, you will see that somebody had the concept of doing this in the between 1900 and 1910, and they had a model of it, drawings of it. It failed badly for a lot of different reasons, and it really went out of favor until probably the mid-60s. But somebody said, hey, this is a problem. We've got these patients with these rotator cuff tears. We can't fix them, and we can't do a regular shoulder replacement. What else can we do? So somebody rejiggered the reverse shoulder replacement, and their concept was to lower the ball of the shoulder in a way that when you lifted your arm up, the part that required a rotator cuff wouldn't rub against another part. So it became, it got looked at again in the 60s. By the mid-80s, interestingly, in France, it became the procedure of choice, and the success rate was really terrific. And little by little, it got, FDA approved around the world. And now it is more common to do a reverse shoulder replacement than it is to do an anatomic shoulder replacement, which used to be the gold standard. So reverse shoulders have actually eclipsed what was the standard form of treatment, and are now more common.
So originally about 1900, someone thought of this. Then it lay dormant for 60 years, and someone looked at it again, and then 20 years later, in the 80s, it finally was adopted.
Exactly. It was a slow burn on it. And everybody looked at it skeptically, even as early as the early 90s, you're looking at it skeptically saying, hey, this does not look like the shoulder replacements we've been using. But the, literature and orthopedics, people have, a number of patients they've done it on. It looks promising. And now you have a problem that is unsolved, which is an unfixable rotator cuff repair. So once you have a problem with no other solution, you're certainly willing to look at something, even if it looks a bit unusual. But it has actually become bread and butter orthopedic state of the art, and reverse shoulder replacements are now done. About 65 out of 100 shoulder replacements are now reverse shoulder replacements. 35 are the anatomic shoulder replacements. So it's been a big a game changer for shoulder replacement surgery.
Great. Dr. Joshua Zimmerman, we are out of time. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak. I know I learned a lot. I learned a lot of things that I had never heard of, and I appreciate you sharing your knowledge.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate being on the air. Thank you.
There you have it, Dr. Joshua Zimmerman, board-certified orthopedic surgeon specializing in shoulder and elbow surgery. Thank you for joining us for JFK Spotlight on Health. I'm Joel Katz. Thank you again to Dr. Zimmerman. JFK Spotlight on Health brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health, JFK University Medical Center. Keep getting better. For more info, go to HackensackMeridianHealth.org. And for a podcast of this show or any previous broadcasts, go to FoxRadioNewJersey.com.